Welcome to the Clinical Research Coach Podcast. I'm your host, Leanne Wolke. In this podcast, we bridge conversations between industry, thought leaders, and patients. Utilizing a unique perspective, integrating years of coaching with Tony Robbins, coupled with scientific and industry experience, we have vulnerable and real conversations with the goal of impacting the industry in meaningful ways. Today on the podcast, we have Daniesca Sandino. Daniesca is currently the Director of Clinical Operations at HCW Biologics and founder of Morning Huddles, a consulting firm focused on clinical trial quality, efficient and effective research operations, and clinical research professional mentorship and growth. Daniesca has over 12 years of clinical research experience in various therapeutic areas. She's served as a lead clinical research coordinator, administrator, department administrator, and supervisor of institutional clinical trial offices, and a director of clinical operations. She's also worked in the biotech industry. Now, she's successfully executed over 80 phase 1-3 clinical trials from study startup to closeout. She's written protocols. She's done a lot. She's well-versed in the clinical trial industry, and I'm excited to have the opportunity to connect with her and to share her insights and wisdom. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for your willingness to come on and to connect. I really appreciate you.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Now, talk to me a little bit about right now you are working as a director of clinical operations and you've seen a lot of challenges that sites face.
Yes, that's correct.
So what would you say are some of the biggest challenges that sites are facing right now?
I believe that in a post-COVID era, the biggest challenge is turnover. Mm-hmm. We have found ourselves in a place where a lot of people want to work from home. A lot of people are moving towards decentralized trials. A lot of clinical research professionals want to be paid market value. So the turnover is excessive, not just on the sponsor CRO side, but on the site level, as far as private site, hospitals, cancer centers, and academic centers. So that's definitely one of the major hurdles. Another hurdle is having processes in place and training. So it seems like, it's almost a cycle. It seems like because of the turnover, no one is able to be trained to the depth that they need the training, and they don't perform as they should. And what I mean by that is that the standard operating procedures are in place, but they can't operationalize them because maybe they don't have the staff or the staff is not trained, or there's just too much workload and not enough people.
You know, I've heard that many times. And what I've heard is, and it's almost like a cyclical effect here, is that I'm hearing that there's green CRAs coming to sites with new study coordinators. And for a lot of times, if you had an experienced CRA, they could kind of help share with the coordinator best practices and help them. But what I'm hearing is that the green CRAs are coming to the sites. The sites really aren't then getting the support from someone who knows what's to be asked. And then they're getting some kind of superfluous requests. Like, you have to do this. And they're like, well, tell me in the regulations where it says I have to do that. But if you don't have an experienced coordinator, they're not able to give that pushback because they don't know. So they're just kind of doing whatever the CRA says. What do you think can be done to address the turnover issue?
So going back to what you mentioned about an inexperienced CRC, I think that definitely goes both ways. I've seen inexperienced mm-hmm. CRCs and inexperienced CRAs. And when I was a CRC, I did meet an experienced CRA, and collaborating with this individual changed my career because things that I had read, things that I had trained on came to life when I worked with this person. And it wasn't a matter of just querying. It was more of this is what I'm looking for. This is how this is done in real life. And I think that a lot of the times, to address the turnover question, when we train our professionals, we don't use real life scenarios and we expect them to be able to put a regulation into practice just with a snap of a finger. So everyone in clinical research knows what 21 CFR is. Anyone that has read 21 CFR knows that it's really just it's a lot of words, a lot to take in, a lot of regulations to memorize. And then when you go and put it to practice, it's the same but also different, right? So you remember the complexity, you remember the root of what the regulation is telling you, but how does it apply to real life? What do you do in XYZ scenario? And I think a lot of trainings don't have that. And that's where it affects turnover because people get frustrated. They feel like they're not doing their job. And then leaders don't understand that perhaps they need to provide either better tools, better training, more understanding, a more comprehensive onboarding program for people.
Yeah, you know, it's funny is that years ago in my career, I was consulting, and one of the things I was doing is I was building custom training programs for companies, and I built out a program for medical liaisons who weren't monitors, but we wanted them to have an understanding of what the monitors did as well as regulations. So I actually built like a dummy case for them and dummy source docs and dummy, you know, like a whole dummy file. And then had them go through it. So they had the experience. And then we reviewed it and they were like, oh, wow, I had no idea all of this was involved. We had the luxury of time, right?
Right.
Because they weren't responsible for studies. It wasn't a real study. And we had staff, you know. So I think that that's something you bring up is this training issue is we kind of throw people into positions and say, okay, figure it out. And by the way, somebody's going to come check your work and they might not know really what they're looking for. So it's almost like this compounding effect of not getting the guidance, the collaboration. How do we, because what I've heard and kind of seen is there's less collaboration than there used to be, or at least from my perspective. So how do we get it so that everybody sees we're all on the same team?
Transparency. There's a method that I like to teach my team, and I like to tell them that direct and transparent communication goes a long way. You never expect people to know what you think they're supposed to know. This you don't know the level of experience of anyone, right? Even during feasibility and during study startup, you may ask for CVs, but you never actually know the level of experience for the CRC or the clinical trial manager or the lab personnel or the imaging personnel, even of the principal investigator. It's been in my experience, many principal investigators are excellent clinicians. But when it comes to clinical research, they know the basics. You know, they don't know the intricacies of executing the trial. They don't know regulatory. They don't know that they have to sign CRFs at the end of a study. So in the training matter and to encompass all of it, it's really important to be transparent and have active communication to set expectations, to provide manuals with clinical protocols. I've had studies that don't provide manuals, and it's a guessing game throughout the entire study. And then I've written protocols where I attach a study manual of procedures. This is how you are going to do this. This is how you're going to do that. I'm trying to keep as many electronics as not as many as the simplest electronics systems and all condensed into one so that you don't have to go to an eTMF, an investigator portal, an EDC, a
IVRS.
randomization, yeah, an IVRS, a randomization system, an imaging system, you know, everything in one is very helpful. And at the SIV or even before, even at feasibility or at the SQV, these things need to be set up front. These are our expectations. These are our requirements. These are our non-negotiables. And these are things that we are able to budge on. And I think that it creates an environment where everyone has a choice. And I was recently at MAGI, the research conference, and it was brought up that a lot of the sites don't like these sponsors that come with 10 electronic systems. And having worked in the site side at a cancer center and a private site, I completely understand that because I would have to have a spreadsheet for all my passwords and all my usernames. And then I would have a day just to go in, just for one study, to go into 10 different systems to enter 10 different things, right? And that is cumbersome. And that does enhance time and effort. And it, maybe not enhancing it in the best way, because that time and effort can be used to recruit patients to document properly. So if we as if sponsors try to minimize the paperwork, let's call it paperwork, or the busy work, and keep it minimal and are transparent and set these expectations at the beginning, then the sites have the choice to say, we can accept this or we cannot accept this.
So when you think about it, you said a lot of great things there. The excessive tech we hear over and over. I've heard sometimes people are asked to log into seven different systems for a study. What's the most that you've ever been asked to log into for one study?
So I had a sponsor that I'm not going to mention, but was very well known worldwide. And we were doing a collaborative study, and they had a different platform for almost every single procedure. So there was an imaging platform, there was a lab platform where I had to download labs, there was an EDC. There was a platform for regulatory documents. There was a platform to confirm eligibility. And then there was a communication platform because they wouldn't communicate via email because their emails were secured. So six. And right. So imagine, I think CRCs will relate to this, especially CRCs that are in hospitals or outpatient centers. Most of the time, if you work with a clinician that has clinic hours from 9 to 5 and you are seeing research patients from 9 to 5, your admin duties, they might not start until 5 p.m. And at 5 p.m., that's when you start pulling out your spreadsheet, logging into all these systems, and then logging in your work for the day. And that's intense. We preach work-life balance, we preach mental health, but then we see these situations. And it's not just the CRC, it could be the whole research team, clinicians, sub-Is included.
Well, and I think that's why we've seen, historically, the industry turnover rate's always been high. But I think it's elevated even more so now, post-COVID, when people are trying to find some work-life balance, or they decided, they just had had enough, whatever the case may be. But when we're asking a lot of people, it sounds like if a coordinator has clinic patients from 8 to 5, and then they're starting their paperwork at 5, it's like a part-time job
Right.
on top of a real job. So I think it's asking more of people than is maybe reasonable.
That is one take. Another take would be to really manage exactly what it takes for one person to manage this study. So I have created tools where it would dictate the time and effort for a staff member. Right, based on the complexity of the study or based on the actual projects that they have ongoing. For a clinical research coordinator, a CRA, a project manager, a clinical trial manager, all the acronyms that we use that are usually the same positions, there needs to be a cap for how much one person can handle. Every single clinical study is a project. And if you are giving a CRC 20 studies, I think your expectations are unrealistic. But I've seen it before. I've seen it working on the hospital side, and I've seen it working on the sponsor side. When we sometimes do feasibility surveys, that we're told that the CRC has 15 studies
Wow.
all enrolling. So you really start to question, okay, does the CRC have a backup? And the answer could be not at this time.
So if they don't have a backup and they've got 15 studies, what do you do?
Well, at that point, based on the complexity of the study, you need to divide the work, right? You need to look at your research, your clinical program as a whole. Are you dividing it? And I'm specifically talking about oncology right now. You can divide it by tumor sites, and you look at your entire program and say, okay, maybe breast cancer has only six active studies. Let's split the work from that and neuro-oncology, if neuro-oncology has 15 to 20. As far as all other clinical trials, I think that when I was in the private site sector, I would definitely have a bigger team and everyone was cross-trained. I think cross-training is just one of the best things that you can do, especially when someone is onboarding or possibly semi-annually, because one, you have a backup if something happens to one person, and two, you always have a system in place where no one feels like they cannot take a day off or a sick day. And that's very important to me personally, because I never want my team to feel like they cannot take a day off or feel guilty or some form of PTSD because they're being scolded because they got sick. You know, everyone gets sick. Everyone has the right to take their PTO. So it's really important to cross train. It's really important to give these excellent research professionals the tools that they need to be successful. And sometimes that includes biting the bullet and hiring more staff.
Well, how do we find the staff when there are these shortages?
There are a lot of people out there that are willing to learn. There are a lot of people out there that don't know the skills that they have that can be implemented into clinical research. Research can be learned and can be learned well. There's a lot of regulations, there's a lot of knowledge literature out there that we can indulge in. Right, but someone has to take the time to let you indulge in it. In every place that I've led, I've set up an onboarding system where you have 3 months to onboard. And this means that in 3 months, you are not responsible for anything. You do get to shadow. And so the first month is all your training, all of your you know, you do all of your trainings, all of your GCP, all of everything, just give you a solid foundation on research, right? Even if you already have one, even if you already have experience, I think a refresh is always, you know, it always puts you at the top of the pile. Then the second month, you start to shadow someone that's more experienced. Why? Because that way you see it one from an outside perspective and you get to ask questions. Who, what, where, when, why? And then the third month, you start going and doing things on your own, but someone is with you and catching little things that you may or may not be doing. So that gives you that confidence that, hey, I did learn in those first 2 months. There are some things I have to work on, which we all do. No one is perfect. But at the end of the third month, you're ready. You're ready to be let go and you're ready to fly.
I love that you put so much emphasis on giving someone who's new that solid foundation. I think when I started in the industry, I was given like a 3 or 4 inch thick binder of SOPs and told, you know, read these. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm not sure this is going to work. And then I think I was out on the road within, gosh, a month or so, co-monitoring with other CRAs. And it was like trial by fire. And then before we knew it, we were traveling 75% to 90% of the time. And you know, the burnout fire was kindling already. So if we're to look at, you know, a solid training foundation gives your employees the ability to feel competent, to feel good, how do you retain them? Because I hear all the time, and I know someone who's new in the industry and they've been in about almost 2 years as a CRA. And they messaged me and they said, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do. All these recruiters keep calling me. And I was like, oh, welcome to the club. Yep, it's going to keep going. How do you keep your staff when they are that hot commodity and everyone's trying to pull resources because they're in hot demand?
Well, that if someone is in hot demand and this is someone you taught, then you did a good job, right? So
Right.
let's start there.
Yes.
And then I think employers and leaders need to be realistic to the fact that no one is going to stay somewhere forever, right? So we need to, as an industry, even as a society, we need to think of jobs in those terms where no one is somewhere forever, right? We are not in the era of staying somewhere for 50 years. And I think that's just the reality of where all industries are going, right? I've met many people in their 60s that have had 3 careers already, and it's quite impressive, and I respect that so much. But as far as keeping the people that you already have, that you've invested your time in, that are good and are excellent, it's a matter of keeping them happy, making them, and by happy, I mean making them feel heard, having the hard conversations, and having the happy conversations, right? Paying them well, paying them market value, having flexibility, but still keeping them accountable. I find that when you treat someone with respect, you give them flexibility, you treat them as their human, you give them the tools that they need, you ask what you can do for them, they respond with more dedication. They're excited to problem solve for your study, for your objective, for your mission, and for your vision. And I think that possibly some turnover is because there's a lack in those things I just mentioned.
It's I was a trainer, or I am a trainer for Tony Robbins, and I was a coach for Tony for a while. And Tony talks about the six human needs, and all humans have them. And there's a need for certainty, so to know how things go. There's a need for uncertainty, that surprise and excitement. There's a need for love and connection, and a need for significance, to feel important, like you're valued and you matter. And then a need for contribution and a need for growth. I think our industry can give someone all of that, but when one of those are lacking, I think that's when someone's more likely to make a change. So I think giving our industry and looking at, like, as an employer, hey, am I giving someone that opportunity to grow? Am I giving someone that sense of importance or significance? And am I giving someone the connection? Do they feel the connection with the patients, which is a lot of times, you know, why we hear sites are so willing to go that extra mile and to do the extra work, because most people drawn to this profession are coming because they really care about the patients. So
Yes.
if we look at that, and I think, you know, I've got some viewpoints even from when I hear from sites that they feel that they're not adequately compensated. And I think, well, okay, typically the person on the other end that's negotiating a budget is someone trained in negotiations, or a finance person who's very skilled at that and Looking at an RFP and or a budget and making sure every line item is covered and appropriate operational costs and looking at all those things, where I think some sites get into trouble because they just want to take care of the patient. So they might overlook the cost of extra toilet paper by having an extra 30 people in their office a month for visits or like silly things like that. But if you add that up, you end up not getting compensated for the work and the expenses that go along with it. So how can sites better negotiate or better estimate their costs when they're creating their budgets?
I just went through a lot of budget negotiations, and I truly believe that if the site has an in-depth, thorough justification for every single one of their expenses, it will get approved. Also, I've seen some sites that put in some expenses that are outrageous, and personally, me having worked on the site side, my initial reaction was, there's no way that you're charging for this.
Give me an example of a like what you would consider like an out there expense.
So an example of that is time and effort for all the staff on the research team for one lab draw. So the patient is going to the lab. The only time and effort is for the phlebotomist, right? But they have, and it's not even a lab draw. Let's say that it's a standard of care lab draw. It's more so APK, right? So this is something that's taken care of by the lab per that site's SOP. Because obviously, when you negotiate budget, you have to learn what the site's SOPs are, at least skim through them if they provide them. So they wanted time and effort for PI, sub-Is, clinical trial director, CRCs, data coordinators, and all of these things. And I understand CRCs and data coordinators, they have to take the time to extract this data from EMRs or even electronic source documents, or some sites still on paper, and enter this data into EDC. But I know that there are some people that will not even see that patient at that visit. So let's be realistic, you know, and let's be a little bit more transparent. I get, and I know this is a common topic in the world of research, that sites don't feel like they're getting paid what they should. And a good justification letter is something that honestly I wouldn't argue with. If you're telling me that this is what it costs and this is how you've done it and this is what's effective, why would I want to take away from that if by you creating a process you're promising me quality?
Danielsko, I think that is such a valid point, is really making sure that the budget and the justification is so clear and laid out that if you're asking for something, you should be able to substantiate it. So perfect point there. What do you think about patient recruitment? Now, I know sometimes I hear sites commit to a certain number of patients because they want to be included in a study. I've had a site, an international site, actually say, yeah, we just tell them whatever numbers they want because we want the study.
So there's a joke among the research profession that whatever a site tells you, divide it by two.
Yeah.
And it has never failed me, honestly. I feel like everyone, so I, at the beginning of a study, when you're recruiting and doing SQVs and study startup, we love that enthusiasm, right? Everyone really wants to get the study. It fits a perfect spot in your clinical portfolio for both sides. The investigators are excited. The research team is excited on both sides. The study team wants to bring in this prestigious site. So everyone is really motivated, enthusiastic. And then this high number is promised, right? Based on the total number, the total enrollment goal in the protocol. So instead of that, I think that a more realistic number should be discussed because you need to look at your practice, right? And this is for clinical trials that are disease specific, not healthy studies, right? Not healthy clinical trial studies for healthy subjects. So I don't see anything wrong with giving a realistic number. It's actually a conversation and a transparent conversation that should be had. I can promise you 10, but based on the traffic at my site, based on my practice, based on whatever factor, the realistic number is 6. And if that information was provided, I think that sponsors and CROs would calculate how many sites they need and wouldn't then have to hound the sites for, hey, you're not enrolling. Hey, what's your enrollment plan? Hey, what's going on? You promised 20, but you have 2 and in X amount of time. And I think that over promising, under delivering is just, it creates a bad atmosphere in the relationship, right? So be realistic with your number. If you over enroll, perfect. You will get a repeat customer.
So being, I mean, being transparent, because if they're going to over promise, under deliver, they're probably not going to be selected next time.
Right. You do think twice. Study startup is a lot of work. So much so that study startup, the way that it has changed in the industry is that there are now job descriptions and roles that are specific to study startup. Because before, when I was a CRC, I did study startup, right? But now there's a dedicated team just to start a study because that's how much work it entails. So if you're not going to be transparent of your enrollment number. I mean, you can say I'm hopeful for 20, but realistically, probably 10. If you disclose that, then it's up to the sponsor, the CRO, to make the decision whether they're going to take you or not. Right? But you do have to remember there's so much work that goes into study startup. Why overpromise if you may underdeliver?
Yeah, it's a lot of work, on the site side to go through the whole process of startup if you're not really going to actually be able to get the patients. What can sponsors do? Many sponsors are working with different vendors to provide recruitment services. What do you think is the most effective thing to give sites to help them with recruitment?
Well, many of the sites that I've worked for, they have actually joined networks of sites, and it's more like a collaborative network where they have patient referrals. So allowing sub-sites sometimes is more beneficial. Even though it's a little bit more work, it's more beneficial to have satellite sites because you can. You know, you if a group of clinicians work at one site, but they have a satellite site in a neighboring county, then this other group can refer to group one. And that really helps. As far as marketing and things like that, I mean, I have done some radio marketing, and I've seen some paper marketing, and I even large institutions use social media. Obviously, everything IRB approved, and that may be effective for some clinical trials for some particular diseases, but not all. So definitely, I think referrals and people that are involved in satellite sites that are that know of the clinical trial and can discuss not the patient or the PHI, but definitely discuss the trial, and they're aware of it, and everyone has either team meetings or disease meeting groups that discuss what's happening within the circle of that hospital or, you know, outpatient centers.
So if we go back to what you said earlier about turnover, so we've got, you know, a study that's trying to recruit patients. There's tremendous turnover. You have a brand new coordinator come in. How can they get up to speed about that study to be able to recruit? Often we see if there's a staff change, recruitment kind of drops off.
That's a great question. I think that time needs to be given to this person to, one, know where their knowledge base is, and two, they need to look at EDC versus the protocol. Mm-hmm. And create a breakdown of that protocol. I think the best way that I love breaking down a protocol is by creating source documents. Even though most sites don't ever use them because now we all chart in EMRs, but creating a source document will make you look at every single detail of that protocol. Yeah. And it's a great stretch assignment, right? You may not ever use them, and that's okay. But suddenly now you know that there's a window for, you know, a CT scan. There's a window for an EKG. There's a window for these labs. You know, it has to be less than 14 days. Things that are in footnotes that you wouldn't normally see when you're being trained on the study. Also giving this person time to look at the status of EDC and know what they're walking into. Keeping a report or possibly a tracker of what's been done, what's pending. Having a system where if someone leaves, the other person can, after obviously their institutional training, they can come in, jump in, and actually get the status of where the study is. I always tell everyone that they should do their job in a way where if they are gone, someone else can jump in. I'm not saying that someone can just come and take their job. That's not what I mean at all.
Right.
But what I mean is someone can jump in and know what the status of things are, because I don't want to delay operations.
Mm-hmm. I think it's there's a danger anytime you've got one person, no matter how competent they are, if they're the only one that knows what they do, you're at a huge liability. I have someone we work with, and he says, "What if I died in a plane crash tomorrow?" I'm like, "Geez, what? Why go there?" But the truth is if something happened to one individual of a team, and no one else knows that content, then it is a liability. So I think cross training, as you mentioned before, is so critical to make sure that your team functions and people can have work-life balance and they can grow into different positions. What do you think about how are decentralized clinical trials and elements of DCT going to impact the industry in the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, it's definitely cost-effective.
Mm-hmm.
However, I am seeing that because it's so new, it's a dance, right? Some sites are ready for it. Some sites have the capability. They've adapted certain technologies. They know exactly what they're going to do. They're going to upload this. They're going to have certified copies of the source documents, or they even give you a de-identified mirror into their EMR. So that's excellent. Some sites, their perspective is just no. We have the EMR, we'll print it out. We have a shadow chart. And if you're going to monitor remotely, we will upload or send it to you in a zip drive. So it's a matter of one of the two has to be prepared to be flexible. And when we talk to sites and when we talk to sponsors and even the relationship between a CRA and a PI and the CRC, and everyone has to acknowledge that we're doing the best we can with the tools that we're given, mm-hmm. that we don't necessarily control what EMR the, you know, your site has. And sometimes we don't control what electronic systems you have to upload. Now, if you're in a place to control them and to choose them, choose the ones that are the user-friendly ones, the ones that have a place for everything, the ones that are structured easily, the ones that you go in and everything is just right in front of you. You know, where a quick training, a quick manual, even put together a manual of tips and tricks for people to go ahead and look into these and get through them.
Yeah, I think it's having something that's comprehensive.
For sure.
We have a system that was built by clinical people. So it was built by somebody who knew the industry and they were like, hey, we need to do it this way because this is what a clinical person is going to look for instead of a SaaS programmer who might, you know, yes. think that they're building it, but not really understanding, like as a project manager or director, senior project manager, like what information do you need at your fingertips to be able to look at those recruitment decisions and safety decisions and those critical decisions that you need to see at any moment and have a trial master file that will be audit proof and friendly and
absolutely
suitable for storage, et cetera. So really important point there that you made. Tell me.
Yes. And I'm glad you mentioned the master file because mm-hmm. I started learning the DIA master file, the DIA reference model, and it has changed my life because it organizes everything for you. And sometimes I just couldn't understand why people wouldn't reference this incredible resource. And I get that we come from the times where there's a regulatory binder and there's a set of essential documents and there's a set of binder tabs, but where did everyone think these binder tabs came from?
Right.
You know, where did these subjects come from? They came from somewhere. So now that we have electronic capabilities to have an ETMF, why wouldn't we structure them the same way?
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously exactly. Tweak it based on your study, but why wouldn't we structure them the same way? Why wouldn't we all share the same knowledge so that we don't feel like we're trying to guess when we're going to a site or when a CRC is asking us a question?
And that's exactly why we use the DIA reference model, and we're actually involved in helping to establish it. So I think that's the difference with something built by clinical versus just like, well, this looks nice here. This looks better this way. Maybe it should be alphabetized instead of with that structure. You know? So just well-intentioned, but there are so many nuances of this industry that the joke is always, you know, gosh, it took my mom 10 years of me being in the industry before she kind of understood what I actually did, because there are those little nuances. Where actually my mom called me this week saying she was thinking about enrolling in a clinical trial. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? She's like, yeah, it's a phase 3. I'm like, oh my gosh, she's got it. It's amazing. What do you think about, you know, we have such a big push right now for more diversity and equity and inclusion in trials. How do we go about doing that?
I'm glad you asked this question because part of my thesis in grad school was diversity in clinical trials. And we all know why. We all want to be represented, especially with all these drugs that come to market, that we want to ensure that can serve the majority of the population or the population that it's intended for. So I think that there's the underrepresented minorities, low socioeconomic communities that are mostly affected by lack of access, right? So creating hubs, creating groups that specifically go and provide these services in these areas where these people may not be able to have that kind of care access. That's incredibly important. Education, teaching these patients, teaching these patrons, because they really are patrons. There are community members, there are patrons. We provide healthcare. Teaching them, getting them comfortable with what a clinical trial is, how it could possibly benefit them or the future generation, and access, right? So creating hubs in places where a hospital may not be available for 50 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe having, you know, a hub or a like pop-up medical center every month for these people. And obviously this is, you know, people will need care more than a couple of days a month or a week a month. And I know that, but this is just a small seed of an idea, right? This can become a nationwide thing where we can send care, we can send clinicians, we can send teams, we can send educators to these places and give these people this knowledge. Or even once they have the knowledge and once they inquire about it, we can pay for their not their time and effort, but at least their travel expenses, so that it's less of a burden. I have some experience with this because I did a project where I called a couple of different hospitals and healthcare institutions, and I asked what a private insurance patient would pay for a CT scan. And what a self-pay patient would pay for a CT scan.
Yeah.
And the private insurance patient would pay something around 5,000, right? But the self-pay would pay around, I want to say, 42. And there's a stigma as to why is the private insurance patient being charged more? And then the self-pay patient, why are they being charged so much as compared to a private CT location, which would charge them $1,200? And obviously there's cost effectiveness, the institution, the brand name, you know, all of these things come to play. But for a person that is of low socioeconomic status, this is not that important to them. The only thing they're seeing is the price.
Yeah.
And the only thing they're seeing is, wow, can I afford a $4,200 CT scan? Probably not.
No, that could be their rent for several months. So do I have somewhere to live, or do I go get a CT scan? You know, and I think that, or do I even know that I can do that? And do I have $4,200 cash to go pay for this?
Exactly. So there's a lot of, I feel like there's a lot of lack of knowledge and possibly distrust within these communities. And well, one is, you know, we need to create programs to educate these communities and then make it accessible. And sometimes these people don't have health insurance. And it's very hard. It's very hard for them to even consider coming in for a clinical trial, because on top of not knowing the whole premise of what the clinical trial entails, their first question is, I don't have insurance. This clinical trial requires consistent visits. How am I going to afford this?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's crucial. When you talk about accessibility, you know, I spoke with Lucy Coasson at Kern Health, which was just acquired by Best Buy last year. And their premise is that there's a Best Buy within 15 minutes of 70% of the US population. So as they have remote monitoring of patients and can move clinical care out into the patient home, it gives more accessibility. What do you think about players such as, you know, Best Buy moving into this space, Amazon, CVS, Walgreens, Walmart, whoever else is going to come in. What do you think about all of these new players coming into the clinical trial arena?
Well, they obviously have good research. They have a good research team because they're trying to fill a gap where it's apparent. Mm-hmm. And I really think that if this moves forward, they really need to acquire people that know research, that know the communities, that can really create or deploy these robust clinical trials that are catered to these communities, that they're ready to train, to educate not just clinicians and researchers, but also potential patients and even their families. When I was on the patient side, I felt the most education happened at the consenting visit. Mm-hmm. And the people that I educated the most were the families, not even the patient. And they have questions. They care about the family members. They have questions about finance. They have questions about insurance. They have questions about who's going to drive their loved one. They have questions about who's going to be there with their loved one while they're at a site for 6 hours. And it does take a team of people, because one person, you can't expect a CRC to go over the finance portion of a study with a patient. They're not even allowed to see that information, right? Yeah. So there has to be a team of educators, the research team, bring a finance person in, bring a social worker. Every patient has to have a team, their community, to help them through this process. So these big players coming into this space, I hope that they learn what we've been trying to teach for a very long time, because it's necessary for, if this gap is filled, it needs to be filled correctly, precisely, and with the patient in mind, at the center of everything. Everything has to be patient-centered.
That's a great point. You know, as we look at some of these players coming into the marketplace, that if it's not patient-centered, it's actually going to undermine research, I believe, because the impression will be like, oh, research is shady. I had to go to CVS and wait 6 hours for a visit because maybe there's only one clinician there that can see patients or whatever it might be. But I think that it's an opportunity to do something very different, but it has to be done well.
Absolutely. I agree.
So I think it'll be interesting to see how it all rolls out in the next bit. These are things I never in my career could have imagined, but they're all here. What would you say has been the greatest takeaway from COVID and what it's done to research?
Well, I definitely think that what I took away from COVID is, if there is enough funds and enough want and need, something can move through trials and market like a rocket.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
When the why is big enough, Simon Sinek says this, if the why is big enough, we'll find a way.
Exactly. And not to discount any other diseases that we've been researching and studying for a very long time, but there was so much push with COVID and the vaccines, and, you know, rightfully so. You know, we were seeing a great amount of people lose their lives in just such a short time. It was definitely necessary. I think another point that I learned is that we can decentralize trials. It is absolutely possible. I think that the pushback is not as necessary as we thought. I think more acceptance of working together with teleconferencing, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's okay if I'm not in front of you, we're still collaborating. I'm still seeing your face. We're still talking. Let's work together to get to the same goal. You know, I don't need to be right in front of you. We can collaborate being two states apart. I think that's a lesson that was a real shocker for everyone, you know, because everyone's used to going into their brick and mortar jobs.
Yeah. You know, and I think that whole industries were kind of brought out of this that transformed the way that we do clinical trials, but will also have a lasting effect on the industry, even as far as telehealth, as far as decentralized trials. A lot of the technology, I think we'll continue to see more acceptance of that. But one of the things, and we talked kind of around it, but there was collaboration that everyone was united around the same mission or purpose. And so how do we bring more of that cohesiveness to our teams to unite?
For specific research teams, I would definitely say that we take the mission and vision of a company, a hospital, a healthcare institution, an academic institution, and we apply it to the macro level, right? But why not drill it down and apply it to the micro level? Apply it to your immediate team members. What is our goal? What is our goal for the next 6 months? What is our goal for this year? What is our goal for this month? What is our goal for this study? What is our goal for this vendor? What do we want from this vendor? Just to give a brief example, I've worked with very difficult vendors, and I tell my team, what do we want from this vendor? Does their product overshadow the customer service? If the answer is yes, let's decide what the goal is. Let's get to that goal, and then we can deal with the rest later, because we don't apply the mission and the vision. I've asked people, what are you doing today at your job that is pushing the mission and the vision of your establishment forward? And most people can't answer that question because they're thinking about the day to day. So yes, the day-to-day is necessary. Everyone needs to do it. Everyone has to do this. You need to get your job done. I get it. But also there is something just a little bigger. And that little bigger could be your team. It could be your partner. It could be your supervisor. It could be a team of, you know, three. It could be a team of 20. But you all have this common goal for the week, for the month, for 6 months, for the quarter. And this is all pushing the same goal forward, and that creates unity. Mm-hmm. So that's something that was exemplified with COVID. We had one goal.
Yeah.
So why not apply it? And what happened with COVID, that is not new, right? That everyone having one goal, MindFrame is not new. We see it all the time, but sometimes we forget. We forget because of daily life and daily interactions and all the things that we pile on ourselves every single day.
So I love so much of your perspective and your passion about this industry and about supporting people in it. What keeps you inspired?
What keeps me inspired? I love to see research come to life. And what I mean by that is writing a protocol. And I consider myself very lucky because before I started writing protocols, I worked with patients. So when I would write protocols and I would see, you know, 20 visits after screening, for let's say, you know, the first cycle of a patient, or even like 20 visits just to finish one screening visit, right? You look at that and you're flabbergasted and you say, why? Why would anyone put themselves through that? So I now try to make it so patient-centric and condense it to the point where I know that the patient is not going to mind doing this, and it's not that much work. It's simplified, but still complex because we do need the data, right? So it's simplified, and I see it come to life, and it's beautiful, right? It's beautiful. Your protocol is coming to life. I'm also inspired when my team does well, because people do well when you give them the tools that they need, when you ask them how you can help them, and when you see that they are pushing through their challenges, when you realize you're not babysitting, and that you're pushing them through their challenges, and they come out of that challenge and they're like, whew, wow, that was hard, but I did it and I feel good. And that's awesome. Who doesn't want to hear that? As a leader, as a colleague, as a team member, who doesn't want to hear that, you know, their team members are being successful? Because that means we're all being successful, right? We're in a good, healthy environment.
I love that. And that also, you know, as we were talking earlier about the turnover, that when people feel appreciated, acknowledged, like they're doing a good job and they're happy, they stay, you know, maybe not forever, right, but they definitely stay longer. I want to be respectful of your time. I have loved getting to sit down and talk with you and your insights and input. Anything else that you want to leave our listeners with?
Sure. So anyone that would that is thinking of coming into the research field, don't be scared. It is incredible. There are so many pathways that you can take, but really lay your foundation for training. I will never forget when I was a research assistant, the senior coordinator that trained me, and I made a mistake in documentation or something, and she was so direct with my mistake, and she, you know, she said, you did this, and it should have been done like this. I never felt demeaned. I never felt any kind of way. And my response was, oh my goodness, I made a mistake. And I owned up to it, and it never happened again.
Yeah.
Right. And after that, it just never happened again. And after that, I expected that from my leaders. I expected that from my colleagues. And it made me love research, because research really is it's experiments, right? We're trying to find treatments that help people. So we are experimenting, and there's so much to learn from this industry. There are so many avenues, and people do ask me, you know, why, how can I get in? Is it too complex? Is it too hard? It's not. It's a beautiful industry that you can come into, that you can learn a lot. There's a lot of camaraderie, but you have to know your stuff. So that foundation is crucial.
I agree. I think it's having that foundation, having the willingness to learn, having the willingness to, if you make a mistake, you fix it and keep moving on. Fantastic. I have loved getting to talk with you. And
thank you for having me. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Clinical Research Coach. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love it if you'd subscribe and leave a rating and a review. I truly hope that you got something out of this episode that can help us all work towards our goal of making a meaningful difference in the lives of others.